This is Luxury.
And Diallo.
The hosts of One Song. And we'd like to thank the United Soybean Board for the sustainable makeover of our podcast studio and for sparking discussions on greener Hollywood production. Check out the Tears for Fears episode of One Song and see behind-the-scenes clips of how they pulled the whole look together. It's all on at Heartbeat Audio on YouTube, and the link is in our show notes.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider, and also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
And now, join Kevin Hart as he dives into the minds of some of the world's funniest comedians. This is Comedy Gold Mines with Kevin Hart.
Welcome, world. Welcome to an all-new episode of Comedy Gold Mines, where we get into the minds of comedians or comedic personalities, of people who just understand funny. And oh, what amazing minds they have. Today's mind, oh man, this is a big one. It's a big mind. Not because of big head. This is a big mind because of accomplishments. I mean, where do I begin? Writer, producer, director, creator. I can go back to my early days. Undeclared. I can go Freaks and Geeks. I can go Super Bad. I can go 40-year-old virgin. I mean, I can literally go This Is 40. The list goes on and on. Ladies and gentlemen, Judd Apatow. Hey, Judd.
How are you, my friend? How's it going?
I'm good, man. Did you hear that introduction? What'd you think of my introduction? Was that a good introduction?
I felt pretty good. I was wondering, how's Kevin going to go with this? How kind will he be? How much will he make me look good? Even when I saw that you had this show, I was like, how long does Kevin wait to ask me on? And I thought pretty early. You know, some people get chosen, like I'm like invite number 200. I'm like, wow, this is early in the Kevin run. He must like me.
I must not only like you, I must love you, Judd. And I think you are an important conversation. I feel like you're a conversation that I not only want to have, but I think people are going to get a kick out of, because you know you're a guy that's behind the scenes. But that's not really behind the scenes. Like you're a behind the scenes guy, but you're so personable and you're so cool about what you do that it's like you've never forced a version of keep me a secret. You're not like, hey, don't show my face. All right. You're not trying to be Batman. You're not trying to be Batman. And I just don't know if people understand or know how funny you really are, man, and how grounded and cool of a person you are. I want to go back, man. I want to go back to my early days with you, because I can get personal with you. I want to go back to what I feel was the reason for my start in Hollywood, Judd. And I know I've told you this before, and we've had our conversations, but you are truly your reason for my early years of introduction and work. And the reason why I say that is because my reason for coming to LA for my listeners was to do a pilot for Judd Apatow. He had a sitcom that he was developing, and the sitcom was called North Hollywood. And in North Hollywood, it starred Jason Segel, Amy Poehler, Judge Reinhold, and
January Jones.
January Jones, that's right. Let's not forget January Jones.
And Adam McKay. Adam McKay.
I talked to Adam, man. Adam McKay in the show as well. Oh my God, when you think about the names just that you have been able to touch, the careers that you've been able to help springboard. But this pilot, this was my reason for moving from Philadelphia to Los Angeles. Judd, it was because of this pilot. I came out, I did the audition, I met with you, I stayed out for a little bit, and when I was in Los Angeles, by the way, no money before the pilot. Not like I was coming out here with a bag full, Judd. It's like saw Los Angeles, I said, fuck, this is it. This is it. This is where I want to be. This is where I want to live. And I remember auditioning and talking to you. And when I left, Judd, I got on a plane as if I already had the role. Like, you know, when you're ignorant to the business, I didn't understand that there was a chance of this not happening.
You didn't know that I had just looked at 25 other people who were just like you.
Yeah, it didn't register. I'm on a plane. They flew me all the way out here. I talked to him. I talked to Judd face to face. And we talked about the stuff, the work. We did a bunch of stuff. And I left. So this is going to happen. So I'm going to move. I swear to you, Judd, that was my that was my mindset. What was the meeting for you and that early stage? When I got out there, do you remember that like audition, that little I don't even want to call it an interview, but I guess it was like a little interview. It was an interview, an audition. It was to get me to do like some improv shit. Do you have any recall of that?
I remember that your manager, Dave, said, this is the guy. And he was someone that I worked with when he was running the improv in San Diego.
Wow.
So you know when you're young and you're not really that good yet, but you got little sparks of it, and maybe you might get good one day. And you always needed those people who would let you have some stage time and treat you with respect, even though you kind of didn't deserve it yet, because they could see the future with you. And Dave Becky was that guy for me. You know, I remember bringing Sandler to perform on a Monday night headlining. I said to Dave, you got to let Sandler headline. Maybe that was off of Remote Control before SNL. And Sandler bombed so bad for an hour straight. He put his back up against the wall at the improv and just ran it. Like, it was just not happening, tanking it. But because back then when he was first starting, people, you know, they hadn't figured out what that was yet. It was so experimental what Sandler was doing in his early stand-up days. So Dave had recommended people to me before, and he was a good friend, and he said, Kevin's the guy. And so when you came out, I was already primed to appreciate what you were doing. And I had seen videos of your stand-up, and I already thought, oh, this is going to work, you know, this combination of people. So you probably did have it in the room, because I'm generally, I'm like a fan. So as soon as you start, probably 20 seconds in, I'm like, yeah, we're done. I don't even need to see much more than that. Because, you know, like when you would see a comedian on TV when you're young, and they just owned you instantly. You'd see like Bernie Mac on something, and you're like, that's my favorite guy of all time. Yeah. And that that's how I always looked at comedy when I'm casting. I just imagine that I'm 15 years old. Would I want to watch that person in the show?
It's crazy that you say that, you know, that you say in a room, you know, right? Like you get it. All right, God, this is the guy. This is the guy. I like this. I mean, I give you your flowers now, because the talent that you have been able to say, oh, I want to work with, oh, this person has the part. Oh, this person here, I'm wanting. Oh, they're my cast. This bucket of people that you have touched, man, for all of these people, and I do mean all, I don't think there's one that hasn't had the star level of success. I don't think that one of your people have not made it to the point of like true star. Like if I were to go through names right now, if we were to go Jason Segel, Amy Poehler, Seth Rogen, James Franco, how do you say Jay's last name?
Is Baruchel.
Baruchel. Yep. Jay Baruchel. January Jones. Adam McKay. Let's go. Charlie Hunnam.
Our buddy Charlie Hunnam.
Our buddy fucking Charlie. Gotta share my Charlie story. Tell the people about the Charlie story. Who else? Am I missing?
Well, who am I to list? But yeah, I mean, but again, it's all as a fan, because, you know, when I was a kid, I'd watch the talk shows, and I'd watch like the Mike Douglas show from Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. That was the big talk show during the day. And he'd have like Michael Keaton on as a comic. And even as a little kid, I just thought, I love that guy. And I'd be tracking him. So I would hear, oh, he's got a new TV show. He had a show called Working Stiffs with Jim Belushi. And I'd watch that. And then it went away really fast. And I'm like, where is that guy? Where'd he go? Where'd he go? And then suddenly he resurfaced in that movie Night Shift. Remember the movie Night Shift?
I remember Night Shift, yes.
The second Ron Howard movie. And I'm like, he's back. I love that guy. And then, you know, he becomes Batman, and then he's, you know, he's the greatest ever. But that's all it is to me. I was always just, would I watch somebody? And so it's just literally personal taste. It has nothing to do with any formula. It's just, I don't know, January Jones came in, and I just thought, I like watching her. She cracks me up. She's, I mean, that was a comedy, and she was really funny. She played a Midwestern girl who had just moved to North Hollywood and had never seen the ocean. And had a romance with Jason Segel, who played Frankenstein at Universal Studios. And that was his job. And his boss was Adam McKay, who used to be Frankenstein at Universal Studios. And now was the manager who oversaw all the Frankenstein.
It's so good. It's
and
so
you were the
good.
Guy who had who was a comedian on the show who had a beer commercial.
Yes.
So everyone was broke, but you had made like 30 grand on this beer commercial. So you were living the life.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I had a tagline and everything. That's the best, the best thing ever, because it was so true. It was so true. Yeah. How did you make the transition, Judd, to this space of writing and creating? Like, what the thing is for you, you know, in your career as a person, like you said, that love comedy, that love stand-up comedy, when did it click that this was a door that was one that you wanted to open? Like, I want to go here. I want to now go this route. I want to start writing and creating television and get to features. How did you start that? When was that decision made?
Well, I was doing stand-up in high school. I went to East Side Comedy Club and Governors. As a young kid, so, Governors. I remember I opened up for Tim Allen at Governors, and my dad goes, "Now that guy's funny." And I'm like, "Well, what about me?
Yeah,
no, but he's funny."
Yeah, son, what you did is okay, but what that guy got up there did, Jesus Christ!
Oh my God, he killed so hard. I remember a woman was laughing so hard, she leaned over a candle and her hair went up in flames.
Yeah.
that's how hard he was killing.
That's crushing.
So I wanted to do stand-up, and probably in the back of my mind, I thought, I'm going to be Bill Murray. You know, that's what you would think when you were in high school. Like, that's the dream, to do that. And I think very quickly I realized, I'm probably going to be more Harold Ramis. I'm going to be the guy either standing next to Bill Murray or the guy writing the jokes for Bill Murray. You know, you notice it as a young person, charisma. You know, you could feel it, you know, when you're starting out at a comedy club. There might be, say, there's 20 comedians around, but there's always somebody that is the magnet and that everyone is excited about. And you can feel it. And here's the weird part, Kevin. As a comedy fan, I always thought, I don't think that's me. Wow. I know when I'm standing next to people that they got the light on them in some way.
Wow.
But I loved being a part of it, and I loved writing jokes. And I also loved writing jokes for people who would fearlessly execute the joke. Mm-hmm. Because I didn't really have the courage to even think of stuff for myself and do it with that much confidence, because I didn't know who I was. But when I was young and I would write something for Jim Carrey, I knew he was going to crush it. He would commit to it like no one you've ever seen in your life. And that was really fun. So at some point, people got breaks. Sandler got some big breaks. Jim Carrey got some big breaks. I met Ben Stiller and created his sketch show with him. And then I thought, well, I guess that's what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to, you know, help people with their careers and coming up with their visions. And then slowly over 10, 15 years, I thought, well, what are my stories? I don't want to just help everyone else. Do I have any stories to tell?
Was the Ben Stiller show, was that one the biggest one? Was that the biggest break at at that stage in your career, like as you were writing and, like you said, doing things with this talent for Sandler, for Jim Carrey? Was a Ben Stiller one, was that like the holy shit, this is different, yeah, this is real, but I can now do this for me?
That was the big one, because before that I had written the Grammys a few times for Gary Shandling, mm-hmm, and I did a couple of Tom Arnold HBO specials. Wow. These comedy specials where we would have a lot of guests on doing sketches, setting up these like reality comedy pieces. So Chris Farley was on one, and Jim Carrey and Stiller and Frank Zappa, people like that would be parts of it. But when I met Stiller, he had just done a sketch show for MTV, which was really amazing, but he just did about a dozen of them. But people knew he was going to do something great. And I just happened to bump into him online at Elvis Costello Unplugged.
Wow.
And he said, HBO is looking for a sketch show. And we started just talking about it. And within 3 days, we had thought of it. And within a week, we had sold it to HBO. And everyone thought we had known each other for years. And we had met a week ago.
And that fast you clicked. This is the shit that really makes me go, wow.
Oh, sure. Because you're seeing something now with your career, which is, how do you create the pipeline, right? Because there's not some stack of great scripts that Kevin could go look at. You know, you might get offered something great occasionally, but for the most part, you're going to create a production company, and you're going to have development people, and you're going to write some scripts yourself. You're going to hire people to write scripts. And to consistently have awesome movies come out over decades requires so much development work. That's the thing that Sandler was always a beast at, is he worked his ass off as a writer and a supervisor to make those movies. And, you know, most people, as you know, they don't do it, right? No. So he's on SNL, and in order to create the movie career, he's got to write that movie, right? So him and Tim Hurley, he write the movie, and then they do it again and again and again. But I remember when I lived with Sandler, and he was just trying to audition for movies, and it almost never worked out, right? Because, you know, someone gives you some crappy scene to read, and you're like, you look like an asshole because you can't make their crappy scene work,
yeah,
in the room at an audition. And suddenly they think, well, he's not very good. And you're thinking, no, your scene is kind of terrible.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you go through that for years until finally you go, I guess I should buy a computer. Yeah. And write it the way I would perform it. Exactly.
And do it myself.
And most people don't do that. Most people, it really takes a lot of fortitude to sit your ass in a chair every day and write the movie or your stand-up act.
It's the toughest thing, in my opinion, in the business. I mean, writers, like you said, to sit there, you're developing and you're in this creative space. When you flow, but when you don't, you don't. You know, and for those that have churned out the material like yourself, I applaud it. I applaud it. And you've done it in such a surgical way. What was the thing after the Ben Stiller show, after you guys developed that? What came after?
So we did that for, we did 13 episodes, of which 12 aired. We got canceled. And oddly, 6 months later, we won an Emmy for best writing. And so we had a little heat off of having a terrible time slot and being mistreated, but people were talking about Ben and talking about the show. So I didn't know what to do. So Shandling said to me, why don't you come write for the Larry Sanders Show? And then I also took a job at the same time for a show that Mike Reese and Al Jean and James Brooks from The Simpsons were doing called The Critic, an animated show. So I was doing half a week at Sanders, half a week at The Critic, and that's how I learned how to write stories, watching them create these episodes.
Okay.
And at the same time, I started writing with Steve Brill, Heavyweights. And so we did this movie about a summer camp for overweight kids that starred Ben Stiller. Kenan Thompson was one of the kids.
Yes.
And that was the first movie that I worked on. And, you know, Disney didn't know what to do with it. It was really dark and weird and silly. And it's become a bit of a cult movie because it's on Disney Plus now. So they put it up on Disney Plus like it came out 8 days ago. And I think more people have watched it this week than watched it in 1996.
When it came out. Yes, when it came out. It's now reborn. But like you said, it is a classic. It is a cult classic.
Well, we did it with a good heart. And I think, you know, you never know, you know, like when you watch your old stuff, you're like, does this hold up? What did I do in this movie? Is there anything in this movie that's going to end my career? Like, jokes are in this movie. And luckily, Steve Brill and I somehow hit a nice pitch where we were talking about our own nerddom and our own otherness through these kids.
Yeah.
So very compassionate to the kids. And so it holds up. Thank the Lord.
That's funny as hell that you say that. You go, holy shit, they just dropped something I did from 19. Oh, God. I mean, Jesus Christ. There's a chance that this thing is going to come in. It's going to come in hot. Brace yourself, honey. We got a fireball coming our way. The phones are going to start ringing. It's hilarious to hear you say that, because that's it's unfortunate, but that's the mindset that we now have to have. In that early time, man, I mean, you're talking about, I'm going to keep on mentioning these names that you're talking about here. You're talking about Sandler, you're talking about Carrie, you're talking about Ben Stiller. You're talking about Larry Sanders, The Larry Sanders Show. You're talking about Gary. I mean, these are all names. I mean, these are such comedy conglomerates, heavyweights at this time. You're getting pieces of all of this. I feel like, you know, all of this humor that you're exposed to, it's rubbing off in some type of way, you know? And now that you put yourself in a position to learn how to write these scripts, you know, did you ever, when was it like, okay, I'm breaking off, I'm by myself, I'm developing these things, and now I'm going after talent to be in the things that I solely develop? Like, when was the decision made to separate from, I don't want to say pack, because it's not like you were in the pack, but you were constantly attached to a person to develop with. When was it, I'm sitting down by myself now, I'm creating this thing, and this thing is going to be a representation of me and my writing talent? When did that come?
I think that happened at some point when we were making The Cable Guy. So I got brought in to produce and do rewrites on The Cable Guy. And after it came out, I thought, you know, I guess I should do the thing that some of my heroes do, like Cameron Crowe and Jane Brooks, which is I'll spend like 3-4 years on one script and try to make a masterpiece of some kind. Mm-hmm. So I had met Owen Wilson when we did The Cable Guy and was a big fan of what him and Wes Anderson were doing with Bottle Rocket. And we wrote a movie together, and I thought that is going to be it. This is the movie. And I worked on it with him for several years. We handed it in to everyone and no one would make it.
Wow.
So it was years of work that led to nothing.
Wow.
And at the time I was doing a lot of punch ups on other people's movies. And then I got a deal and I met, I knew Paul Feig, and I said to Paul, you have any ideas? Because I have this deal. And one day he just dropped Freaks and Geeks on me. And I think from watching Paul work on Freaks and Geeks from such a personal place, and it also forced us as the writing staff to give up our personal stories, that's when I realized, the gold is in going deep into yourself. And
was Paul, did Paul act as like a mentor in any way?
Well, It was a funny type of relationship, because I had a deal. I looked up to Paul. I met Paul when I was 18. Mm-hmm. And he was, you know what he was on at the time? This is like 1986, 87. He was, what was that movie with Patrick Swayze and Jennifer Grey? Dirty Dancing. So he was on Dirty Dancing, the series. So we're all kids. Feig's got a real job on a real show. That was like very impressive. So we had known each other for a long time as comics. And then I think in reading what he wrote, it became a way of understanding by watching him, by watching Shandling, like, oh, my friends who tell their truth are breaking through in some way. And so on that show, I told some stories through those characters about when my parents got divorced. I would use details. And there was a scene where Martin Starr's character comes home and he watches Gary Shandling on the Mike Douglas show while eating grilled cheese sandwiches and chocolate cake, and it's to the Who song, I'm One. And it was a really sad scene about being a latchkey kid and getting your pleasure alone watching comedians on talk shows. And that was a scene I wrote and directed, and I finished it, and Jake Kasdan, the director, said to me, I think that's the best thing you ever did, and that's the most personal thing you ever did. And that's when I think in my head clicked, like, oh, all this stuff I thought no one would give a shit about is actually the only thing they care about.
That they care about. It's kind of crazy, yeah, because it's like that in stand-up comedy. You know, what you just said, I think there's a direct parallel to stand-up comedy. It's a moment of stand-up comedy when you realize that you can be yourself.
Yeah.
There's a moment when you realize that you can be yourself, and that sharing your personal experiences, good or bad, trials, tribulations, whatever it may be, are where you get the biggest and best response. So I think in writing, it's the same.
Yeah,
absolutely. It's truly parallel. And I think, you know, to your a nod to you, like within the characters that you have put on screen, they've all been so personal. I feel like you spent so much time in truly developing the characters to where, like, the characters, there's a high level of care that goes into every character that's been in a Judd Apatow film. Like, it's oh my God, I get that guy. I am that guy, or I understand that guy. And you know, you want that now. You know, I think that's so big in our movies today. We're constantly looking for the relationship with the character as an audience. Like, I want the relationship with the character. What am I taking away from this character personally, or what do I identify with personally? I don't want to be so far separated from a character to where I just have no clue of what the fuck is going on, because I would never do, or I never done. You know, I want a sense of self somehow, some way. And I think that you've been able to do that. And saying what you just said makes sense. Like, you taking away from your life the things that you've done and making the decision to implement those in your work.
Hi, it's Stephen Colbert, and I'm here to tell you about The Late Show Pod Show, which is the podcast of The Late Show with me, Stephen Colbert, and I'm here with my producer of the podcast, Becca. Hi, Becca.
Hi, Stephen.
So what do people get when they listen to The Late Show Pod Show? Let's sell this thing.
The extended moments, for sure, because we run out of time for broadcast, but we have plenty of time on the podcast.
It's kind of like being a live audience member of the show, because you get things that no one else hears. Listen to The Late Show Pod Show with Stephen Colbert wherever you get your podcasts.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries plus napkins plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
In the early days, favorite movie you did? Is it The Cable Guy? Is that one of them? That has to be one of them, Judd.
Definitely, because it was just weird that we were making a movie and had a big budget, and Jim Carrey, the funniest man in the world, was there, and it was blowing our minds that, you know, we had the toys, you know, to make something. And Jim certainly was very interested in not repeating himself. He didn't want to do Ace Ventura or The Mask again, and so he created a really dark, twisted character, and Ben had so much fun making a thriller, basically. It was a dark comic thriller. But also, I think, you know, when we did 40-Year-Old Virgin, I felt like my sense of humor, you know, inspired by Carell. I wrote that with Carell. I had, you know, Seth Rogen, you know, helping, you know, as a producer and an actor on it. You know, that was where I felt like, okay, this is my sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, having you there was, you know, a highlight. I mean, I think about that day a lot of just how funny everybody was. And I think that whole set was a lot of people just on fire. Jane Lynch is just crushing it, Romney and Jerry Bednob. And then Carell, we all sat there and wonder at how funny He was, because he, you know, he just crushed it on Anchorman. And I thought, well, I'd love to watch a movie that was all Steve. And then he had this idea to play the 40-year-old virgin. And the second he told me, I thought, well, I know what that is.
Oh, well, we got stuff to pull from here. We can go in deep on this one. I'm gonna tell you what's so good about the 40-year-old virgin. Romany Malco getting that part was the best thing to happen to me. It was the best thing to happen to me, Judd, because there's a moment where you think you're at a certain place in the business. For my listeners, the 40-year-old virgin, I had went out for the part that Romany Malco got, which was a great part. I was like, oh my God, this can be it. This is life-changing. This is the role of a lifetime, etc. Like there was so much that I had put on getting that part. And I didn't end up getting it. Judd gave it to Romany, and Judd brought me back to do the cameo that I did, where I come into the store, me and Romany end up getting into it, and the scene is improv. Like, he just let me and Romany go, and gold came out of the scene. But Romany showed me that I was not ready for that type of part. Romany showed me that I was a little green in certain ways, right? Like, it was... I still needed some polishing, some fine tuning. And it was after that that I made the decision to go get like an acting coach, to go sit with somebody to really break down acting to me and what I should know and understand as I'm reading these scripts or breaking these, you know, going to these auditions. And I remember after the movie came out, Judd, watching Romany's performance, and I was like, that's who was supposed to have it.
Something about that is a couple of things. One, from the moment we started working together, I honestly always thought, oh, Kevin's the guy, right? Mm-hmm. And so in my head as a comedy producer and fan, I'm like, oh, how do you break Kevin? So we did the pilot, then you did a bunch of episodes of Undeclared. And then when it's time for that movie, there's nothing I want more than to have you in the movie. But when we were going through the casting process, more than the idea of your acting talent, because that wasn't my concern, mm-hmm. I just realized it needed to be an older person. Mm-hmm. That the point of the movie was, this was a guy who had a lot of experience with women, had slept around a lot, and was the worst person to give you advice.
Yeah, he was a fucking machine. Romany was a...
And you were so young at the time, maybe you were 25 or something, mm-hmm. That just instantly, when you came in, it was like, oh no, this has got to be an older person.
Yeah.
And so, which is the bummer for me, but I was so thrilled that you killed in the movie, because sometimes the part's just not the right part.
But you don't have that understanding and young in your career. There is no lesson or book that you can read that breaks down right for the part, wrong for the part. It's, oh my God, fucking part. they don't want me. They Judd doesn't like me, man. I don't know why he doesn't like me, man. Why wouldn't he give it to me, Dave? You know, you don't have that. You don't have the logic to digest that. So it's just, oh shit, this didn't work out. Oh my God, I gotta get better. And that was the mindset that I took from that. I gotta get better. And then watching it, I just remember Romany just being so good. You know, me and Romany are so close. We're friends until this day. We worked together several times and we talk about that. I'm like, dude, like you just changed my perspective on a business and made me take a different approach to just preparation. So right or wrong for the part, granted, it makes sense, but at the time I took it as I gotta get better. And that's what I'm saying that moment was. And then that scene ended up being like one of the biggest fucking scenes ever. Like it's something that was on my reel in the beginning stages that got me, you know, I can't even tell you the amount of comedy clubs that I got into because of the 40-year-old virgin and because of the guy from the 40-year-old virgin. There was so much that was able to trickle from that.
It felt like also helped. You got your thing across. Like, oh, yes. This is what Kevin does. So by creating an environment where you could experiment, you felt supported, we're improvising, but with, you know, clear directives that you grabbed the reins and said, this is what I do. This is how I would be in a movie. Mm. If you gave me the whole movie, this is the beginning of what it might look like. And that was an important thing. But the bigger issue for me was I didn't really have that character. I did a table read of that movie and all the friends of Steve bombed.
Wow.
Right? Rudd bombed and Rogan bombed and Romney bombed. And wow. I was like, I thought that the relationship between Steve and Catherine Keener would be the hard part. At the table, it crushes. And I realized that I had not developed the friends. And what Romney did is he created that character. That wasn't a character that I understood. I couldn't tell you how that person would speak or how they would relate to everyone. So we went into rehearsals with Seth, Paul, and Romney, and we just talked about it and riffed and improvised. And Romney, I mean, I, in all honesty, if you watch that movie, 80% of that Romney wrote himself.
Holy shit.
I mean, he crushed all of that every
Holy
day.
Holy shit. That's huge. That's huge. But that's also, I think that's a dope thing about how you work. Like when you do those rehearsals and you go in and there's the improv sessions and the back and forth and you know how you're taking notes from that. You're allowing your talent to bring things to the table. And Steve in that process, how was Steve with the improving and the back and forth? I mean, I look at Steve as one of the best to do it when it comes to
incredible.
That.
Yeah. Just ridiculous. So open, so funny. The set pieces that he wrote in that movie were just incredible. And, you know, the thing that I like about early movies with people is they just work hard. You know, when that's a movie's meant to be your big break, you are going to stay up late trying to make every scene
busting your ass
amazing.
Busting your fucking ass.
And that's what Steve did. And he could just riff all day. We both had a sense that the crew was so annoyed with how much we were improvising, you know, because the crew had just done all these Clint Eastwood movies where he does one take.
Yeah.
And we're going on for hours some of these scenes.
We're rolling.
We're doing that poker scene where they slowly realize that he's a virgin. Hours of riffing. And the crew would look at us like, can we fucking go home already? Can we leave? Like, can you guys stop whacking off so we can go home? But that's what it took to find all those moments.
To find the gold. Here's a tough question for you. This is a tough one.
Yep.
If you had a dream cast, right? Mm-hmm. You get a dream cast, you get five. You got a cast of five, and you got two cameos, Judd.
Yeah.
Five of your comedic, your comedic personalities that you love. Give me your cast of five. Give me your two cameos. No pressure to put me in this. No pressure.
Five plus two. Okay.
Five plus two.
Okay. Five plus two. This is really a brutal, brutal question. This is like when they ask people like their top five rappers, and how angry everyone is.
This is a great question for you. A great question.
Okay. Well, I'll put you in first. I'm going to try to think of the people I haven't worked with.
Okay. Okay.
And I will have the caveat that there's probably 20 more, but I'll still do it.
Okay.
So I'll say, you know, I got to go Steve Martin right off the bat.
Insane. Love it. Love it.
This could be, I don't want the whole show to be taken up by this because my brain is melting
with the possibilities. I like this panic. There's pure panic. There's panic on Jed's face right now. There's a shitload of panic on Jed's face right now. Steve Martin, that's a great fucking cast member. I love it.
Yeah, so we'll say Steve Martin, let's say... I mean, I kind of have to go, like, it'd be fun to try to really do something incredible with, like Chappelle.
Chappelle. Gosh, Chappelle and Steve Martin. Already, the poster's getting great. The poster's already forming.
I would say, you know, Kate McKinnon, but I'm about to work with Kate McKinnon.
Doesn't so matter. Kate's a comedy beast. A comedy beast. I love Kate.
I'll say Kate. I'll say Zach Galifianakis.
Zach, right now you're strong. Let's go over. Steve Martin, Dave Chappelle, Kate McKinney. Oh, my God. And now you add Zach Galifianakis. Come on, man. This poster is unreal. I want to see the movie already. Give me one more.
Maybe Michaela Cole.
Oh,
from I May Destroy You.
Yes, that's strong, Judd.
That was as good as it gets.
That's strong.
Cameos. When I got you to do two cameos.
You got two cameos.
Well.
Two cameos.
Phoebe Waller-Bridge.
Oh, strong,
right?
Strong.
And
for my listeners, this is what I tell you. Look at the mind. Look at how the mind works. Look at his comedic mind. Look at how deep he's going for his comedy pulls.
It hurts. I'll miss 30 of them, but then. I'm trying to think who really makes you laugh hard. You know, like people that make you piss.
You got a hell of a list.
I'm gonna surprise you at the end. Ready?
Okay.
Surprise you at the end. I'm gonna say Nathan Fielder.
Holy shit! Out the left field. Where'd you pull that
Nathan,
from?
Nathan for you.
Where did you pull that from? Goddamn.
Who makes you laugh really hard?
I mean, Nathan's funny as fuck. What do you mean? Yeah. Nathan's funny as fuck. That's a great list. Let's talk about stand-up, man. I can't not get into stand-up with you right now because you started there. You loved it. You got into this world of writing, and, you know, there was a moment where you backed off of it, and then you fell in love and said, I'm going to revisit it. I'm going to do it, but I'm going to go hard at it right now. Where are you at with stand-up comedy, Judd?
I did not write one joke during the pandemic. I only even had one comedic thought, which was, and this is how lame I've been for a year. My only thought was, every time someone mutes on a Zoom, they're farting. That's all I thought of in a year. That's as deep as it got.
That's just stand-up comedy muscle right now.
I wrote a Chana movie. Well, I don't know. I was in England. I made a movie for Netflix called The Bubble, about a group of people trying to make a dinosaur movie during the pandemic and everything goes wrong. And I just got back from London shooting that movie. And so all my energy went into that because I just got so bored of sitting around. Yeah. And, you know, I found it hard to write stand-up when I felt like society didn't really exist in its normal form. So it's hard to observe your everyday life because your everyday life is so strange. And ultimately my mind said, I guess I should just make fun of what's happening right now, which is how am I going to make a movie during all of this? Yeah. And that's what I spent my time on. I'd like to go back. It's so funny because in my head, I really did think maybe you should never go back. I had that feeling. And then I was talking to Mike Birbiglia yesterday and he said, they're playing a lot of cuts from your album on Sirius and they sound really good. And I said, you're my comedy angel. I'm not going to quit.
Yes. Out of nowhere, a sign just came at you. You didn't expect it. Mike gave you a saving grace verbal sign. I mean, I think that's what a lot of comedians are. I think there's some comedians, you know, Dave is so sharp right now because Dave was, you know, he was in that comedy gym in Ohio. So he's sharp as ever. I talked to Rock. Rock has got some shit. You know, he said he's feeling good. I told him, I said, I got nothing. You know, I'm in the boat that you have. I'm in the same boat as you, man. I got fucking nothing. And
how many hours have you written? How many specials have you done so far?
I've done seven. I've done seven specials.
I mean, 7 hours, and probably for every special you had 90. That's right. So you cut out a half hour to get to the hour.
That's a lot of it's a lot of comedy, man. And you know, I definitely didn't have the thought that you just said of maybe I don't do any more. But it was like, you know, maybe it's just the road, and maybe I'm back on the road and I wait for a special. Like, cause you do got to figure it out. You got to figure out like what is life now, and what is my take on life now? Like, are we back to normal? Are we, what are we now? Like the biggest thing for me is greeting. You know, when's the last time you've been able to greet a person normally? You come in, it's like a half fist bump, half shake, a midway attempt for a hug, a stop. It's like these are the things that have just gotten weird. So I'm a people person. I need people, Judd. So it's not until I'm able to really be around people that I can generate this thing again. I don't know when that will be. You know, I've just been on these movie sets, TV sets. So I think when I get done some of these productions, I'm going to go and just kind of figure out what that is. Maybe go to New York. Maybe we go to New York, Judd. Spend some time in fucking New York. Maybe I tell you when I'm going.
Yeah.
And we go for like, you know, 2 weeks or something just to fuck around, just to step in some shit and see if it stinks. Right.
That's right. See what our dual bill is.
Yeah, see
we
what
get
I,
up
see,
there.
This is Luxury.
Andy Allo.
The hosts of One Song. Shout out to U.S. Soy and the United Soybean Board for supporting this podcast and for giving our recording studio a sustainable makeover.
Just like music is made of notes and beats, each eco-friendly choice we make contributes a single note that completes the overall melody. That's why Heartbeat and U.S. Soy are teaming up to lead the discussion around greening Hollywood. We're talking slashing the carbon footprint of production with soy-based alternatives like soy-based inks for printing scripts, soy foam for soundproofing studios, and even biodiesel generators to power sets.
To see our podcast studio transformation, watch the Tears for Fears episode of One Song and see behind-the-scenes clips of how we pulled the whole look together. It's all on @HeartbeatAudio on YouTube, and the link is in our show notes.
How old are your kids now?
Man, fuck, I got four of them, Judd. I'm 16, 14, 3, 7 months. Four fucking kids. It's insane.
You had a kid during the pandemic?
During the pandemic. I got a pandemic baby. Little pandemic is what we call her. That's little pan. Come here, little pandemic. A little pandemic baby. I can't believe I got four kids. Four fucking
that
kids.
Your kids are,
aren't your kids like 30 now? How old is your goddamn kids? Jesus Christ.
Well, I'm about to be an empty nester in 3 weeks.
It's
so
insane.
I'm about to have that.
Are you serious? She's out.
She's out. And so that is how long we've known each other, because I didn't even have Iris when we met. And so
Judd, she's out the house.
So now you have to write the I have babies routines again. The bits you did 14 years ago, you can recycle.
Oh my God. I know you're about to lose it. How's Leslie? I mean, I know she's probably gonna be a wreck when she leaves the house. Who's it gonna hit harder?
I think you know what you do? You make a choice to either be in complete denial that it's happening, or you're just looking at photos all day long crying. And that, so it's one or the other, because there's a part of you that's like, I've had to wake up at 6:30 in the morning for the last 23 years. And you could rejoice at like that extra 90 minute of sleep. Like you could go, it's about to change. I can travel. I have freedom. I'm not locked into the school schedule. Or you can go the other way and just go, it's over.
Oh no.
I think it all
depends on the kid's level of excitement too. What's her excitement to get out of the house? I feel like when they're too excited, it's frustrating.
Yeah.
When it's like, I'm out of here. 2 days. Yeah. The bus is coming.
I feel like that because when Maude went to college, she would FaceTime us like on almost every walk to class. Mm. So it didn't feel like she left.
Okay.
Because she would like have a 10-minute walk in the snow to class, and then she would just want to FaceTime the walk. And so they felt very present. But if you have a kid that doesn't want to do that, who's like happy to check out for a couple of weeks, I think that'd be pretty brutal.
Yeah, my son is like that. My son's a jackass. My son doesn't respond to text, call. My son, he's not a phone person. It's at a point where I'm like, dude, do you love your father? At this point, I'm really starting to just question your level of care. He's like, Dad, I just don't have my phone. Like, he truly could give a shit about his phone. Leaves it home. He is. That's why it's like I'm halfway irritated, but then I'm not. Like, I like the fact that he's not into the social media. He doesn't care. He truly doesn't give a shit about it. But the consequence is like you can't get to him sometimes.
Do you have the programs where you track them, like the Find My Phone, and you can see where they are?
Yeah, Life 360. You got Life 360?
Yeah, I don't have that one.
Life 360. It's an app where the whole family is on the app, and you just know where they are. It's more important so you know where your kids are, you know, because they're at that age. They're at that age where they can, I'm going here, but they're not where they say they were. And, you know, it's not that I just need to know where you are just in case. Yeah. That's my thing. I'm not the crazy dad, but I need to know where my kids are.
Yeah, I never wanted to be tracked. That was a big thing in the family. And they think, like, well, what is he up to? But really, it would just be like, oh, look, Dad's at Baskin Robbins. He's on his way to Carvel.
Yeah.
And I'm just moving. Like, that's all I'm doing is eating what you don't want me to eat.
Well, me and my wife, we turn ours off because it isn't for us. It's for you. So it's like, you know, we're the adults here. So this is for us to understand. You know what I mean? Like, it's a barrier in that. You're not going to know where we are to judge what you can do based off of where we are. It's a thing. It's like a double sneaky thing happening here. Like, we're out sneakying one another. No, you're not going to know where I am, so you know what you can. No, we're turning ours off. That way, so you don't know where we are. Yeah,
don't you know what party I'm at.
Yeah, you don't know what fucking what shindig we are at. No, not at all.
I tried to teach my kids to be known as people who don't respond to texts. I said the best thing you can do is be known as flaky. Because when your friends are looking for you, if you have that reputation, like sometimes she doesn't answer, then you can move through the world any way you like.
Yeah, you're okay.
But if you're known and then they want to reach you and they're like, she saw it. I know she checks.
Different. You're in trouble. It's a different thing that comes with that. Give me the want for Judd Apatow now, man. What do you want to do now? What are you looking to do? At this point, life seems to be rearing its head again. Is there any material that you're working on? Is there a new level of development or creative that you're looking to attack? What's the mind of Judd? What's next?
Well, the movie I just did is really silly. Mm-hmm. Karen Gillan is the star of it.
I love Karen, man.
And so I kind of thought, you know, I've done some deeper movies. I did the movie with King of Staten Island with Pete.
Great movie.
You know, movies that are dramatic and funny. And I thought, I think in this movie, people just want to laugh their asses off. They want to break. Mm-hmm. So I fully embrace like a ridiculous, dumb movie with dinosaurs and madness. And that felt right. So I'm not sure if after that, I'll want to swing back to something more substantial or just go deeper into idiocy. There is a part of me that thinks the world needs a few years
of
just hard comedy. And, you know, because that is fun sometimes to just go, how funny can a movie get? Like, can you really crush wall to wall? And I don't think people ever understand how hard it is to make a consistently funny movie. It's a miracle.
I mean, I definitely think we're missing the last one that I would say that was able to hit a home run on all sectors, on that rated R level of comedy. I'm gonna go two.
Yeah.
The first Hangover hit a home run.
Yeah.
On so many levels of that big comedy thriller like adventure, but edgy, raw. It's like, fuck, this train just didn't stop. And the laughs kept going with it. Like, that was a big fucking comedy, right? Mm-hmm. we're definitely missing the next version of that type of comedy, that level of edge within comedy. A movie that was fucking, that was really good, Good Boys.
Yeah.
Good Boys. Good Boys, yeah, tapped a lot of boxes for me with those kids, with comedy, with the edge. Like my thing is that R, you know, that rated R in comedy. And I know that we look to go and you know, kind of studios always want to play in that safe space of getting families and everybody in there. But I'm pushing for that R, or that close to R, edgy, thriller like comedy. And you know, I've yet to crack the code on what it is, on what it, you know, what that movie is. But that's what I want, Judd. I want that fucking R.
You want R. The movie that just goes way farther than you expect it to go. Yes. I mean, that's usually what it is. Even if you watch Airplane, there are some shocking jokes in Airplane.
If you watch it again now, you'll catch them.
Oh,
too.
Yeah. So yeah, yeah. You'd be like, wow, you wouldn't do that one right now.
Are you tiptoeing, though, within the development of your movies? Do you feel like there's a level of tiptoe of, okay, wait, let's pull back. We can't do this. We can't do that. Is there a fear of like, well, I don't want to go too far because of the things that'll come with it? Are you mindful of that stuff now while being creative?
I mean, my thing has always been, if your heart is in the right place, I think you can do anything. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't certain people who won't complain. And everybody has different tastes, and some people are, you know, looking to be offended by things. But I always think about what Colin Quinn said when he was promoting his book, The Coloring Book. They were asking him about humor and what you can say and what you can't say in political correctness. And he said, I think you can say anything as long as you mean it. I don't think you could be sloppy. And I think that that's true. Because if the message of your joke or the point of bad behavior in a movie is for people to realize that that's bad behavior, mm-hmm, well, you still should be able to do that. Movies are always about people who make horrible mistakes on the way to learning something. So you don't want people who are like, well, you can't even make mistakes in movies,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
because then they're not funny at all. The only thing that makes us laugh is outrageous behavior and terrible really choices. You know,
that's a really good point. That's a strong point. You know, you're kind of putting up a lens. I'm giving you a POV into something that is wrong, or something that people do that's wrong, and we're gonna do it in this film, and then we're gonna have a road to correct it in the movie. Because we did that, we shouldn't be judged, or we shouldn't be viewed a certain way. That's a strong point of view. I like that. Not that I haven't thought about it, but I don't think I've worded it that way. The way that you just worded it was a lot better than I may have tried to word it in development, you know, and now.
Well, I always say it this way. Normal behavior is never funny, right? Ah. Like somebody who acts appropriately is the death of comedy.
Wow. Another fucking good point. Damn it. Where was I at? Why don't I don't have any. Normal behavior is not funny. That's Judd. That's Judd Apatow. Look at that. That's fucking genius. It's so simple, but so profound. Normal behavior is never funny, and it's true. It's true. Nobody wants to watch a perfect person. It's not funny. It's not fucking funny. It's not good.
I remember in Stripes when Bill Murray, the opening scene is he gets mad at the woman in his cab, and he pulls over in the middle of the bridge and chucks the keys into the river. Right? That's comedy.
It's fucking so absurd that it's comedy. By the way, still, pound for pound, one of the funniest people walking on this earth, man. What about Bob? What about Bob, Judd? What about Bob is one of my favorite
movies. What about Richard Dreyfuss and What About Bob? Come on.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. He's What About Bob? What About Bob is such a good movie. It's such a good movie and such a good performance from both leads. It's so good. So, like, I mean, it's one of the few movies that I have on an iPad. And I'm not an iPad movie watcher. I have What About Bob on an iPad because that's a movie that I have no problem watching over and over again. What About Bob?
I watched it a lot when we did Cable Guy. You know, that genre of the new friend who won't go away and ruins your life. That's a nice genre.
That's at that point, yes. At that point, that was the thing. That was the fucking thing. The guy or a woman that comes around as a friend and you just can't get rid of them. You know, yes. It's funny you said it. Do you feel like comedy has its, it's generations of the new thing that's being presented? Like how you're talking about the friend that wouldn't go away. You know, what do you feel our comedy thing today is? What's the thing that they say we're looking for today?
Well, right now, well, I don't know. This is the thing that we have to figure out, which is what captures the mood of this moment. I mean, in the movie I just made, I was trying to make fun of the idea that we all think we're going to learn a lesson from the pandemic. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the humor comes out of people profoundly thinking about like what they learned from this, and clearly they're not learning much. But, you know, there is an argument that we should bring back every hacky convention from the 80s and 90s and just make Spies Like Us over and over again.
One of my execs, they called me and they had a meeting with one of the studios, and I'm like, yeah, we're looking for like this like the next Beverly Hills Cops. And I'm like, well, I said, whoever that person is, I said, tell me, because they should be punched in the face. Like whoever is still bringing up we're looking for like the Beverly Hills and the Cops, like they should be punched in the face to use that as a reference of what we're looking like or what we're looking for today. Like tell me that exec that you met with so I can FedEx him a stiff punch to the fucking mouth. Ladies and gentlemen, man, I don't think that there's more information that can be given. I love having these conversations, and I love having them for this reason. I mean, not just the stories, but just the dialogue, the conversation, and what comes out of them. Judd, dude, truly, thank you, man. Thank you for coming on Comedy Gold Mines. Thank you for being a friend. Thank you for being a teacher and a mentor in this business, man. And I love that you are forever you. You have not changed. You've been the same with me and towards me throughout the duration of my career, man. And I hope that it never changes. I hope that you and I continue to grow in our relationship. This is fucking dope, man. I appreciate you.
Oh, absolutely. I'm thrilled for everything that's happened to you. And it's all as I predicted. That's how I look at it. It's all as I predicted. Every detail that happens in your day, I predicted.
You knew. Judd knew.
I knew that one day that you'd write a self-help book and then I would read it for my own self-help.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Comedy Gold Mines, and oh my God, what an amazing mind this was. Judd Apatow. Thank you, Judd.
Comedy Gold Mines is a Sirius XM and LOL audio production. Executive produced by Kevin Hart, Ty Randolph, and Eric Weil. With Tastemakers Media, Emil Garner, and Ian McDonald.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries, plus napkins, plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this, plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, Essential Plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.